On Air with Omsnick is a podcast intended to provide information only on certain risk management topics and is not to be construed as providing legal, medical, or professional advice of any form whatsoever. Because federal, state, and local laws vary by location, nothing in this podcast is intended to serve as legal advice or to establish any standard of care. Legal advice, if desired, should be sought from competent counsel in your state. The views or opinions expressed by the guest do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Omsnick or its subsidiaries.
Hello and welcome to On Air with Omsnick, a podcast brought to you by Omsnick, the leading medical professional liability insurance company owned by OMS that exclusively insures OMS. I'm your host, Bill Klaproth. And with me is Richard Small once again. This is part two of a two-part series, this time with a focus on practice models available to OMS. This is an important topic for OMS entering practice or those considering a change in their current employment situation. Richard, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time and expertise as both a defense attorney and insurance agent with over 30 years supporting OMS in practice.
Thanks, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
So let me ask you this. Why do you think this topic is important for a resident's transition to practice or practicing OMS considering a change in practice model?
Understanding the differences between practice models can help oral surgeons make more knowledgeable decisions about where and how to practice.
So for those who may not be familiar with the evolution of practice models, can you back up and briefly describe how they came to be?
Yeah, that's a good question, Bill. Because practices were different 40 years ago. Almost all were owned and run by oral surgeons. Only two or three parties were involved in those days, the OMS, the patient, and sometimes a dental insurance plan. Things started to change in the 1980s. Managed care and third-party payers started playing a larger role in dental practices. During the last decade, DSOs, management companies, corporate practices, and contractual incentives influence the OMS workforce, including allied staff, oral surgeons, billers, and others. This isn't good or bad, it's just more complicated to analyze compared to simpler times when OMSs only dealt with a patient and a payer. Most oral surgeons didn't have to hire a CPA, lawyers, billing specialists, consultants to run the practice, as is commonplace today. Just ask a mature OMS who's been practicing for a few decades.
Right. So, Richard, what specifically has become more complicated as a result of practice model changes?
Well, some practice models have adjusted operational and patient care protocols to improve efficiency. Allied staff or other providers have been asked to assume more responsibilities, including patient assessment, scheduling, getting informed consent, and or post-procedure responsibilities. As corporate-run practices and managed care organizations play a more active role, OMSs may be pressured to be efficient, more profitable, or more business-like. In some practices, the focus shifts to being more profitable as opposed to putting patients' interests first. These two goals, however, are not mutually exclusive.
So it sounds like these changes to practice models have resulted in less than ideal practice conditions in some cases.
Well, not in all cases. Making a profit and putting patients' interests first do not have to be in conflict. Some business-oriented and corporate models do a good job of incorporating business efficiencies while still serving the patient's best interests.
What do you recommend OMS do to try to better understand the operational and patient care protocols of a prospective practice, especially if these practice models continue to evolve?
Well, from my perspective, a good starting point is to understand what standards and guidelines the practice will impose. These standards can be defined through state law, federal law, and through guidance set by AMIS. Note that some employment agreements reference, quote, standards and guidelines, end of quote, but these usually are not attached or provided during negotiations. In a large group or corporate practice, I recommend that the oral and maxillofacial surgeon try to identify who owns the practice. This information can help oral surgeons understand the practice structure and what and who may influence practice decisions. Finally, OMSs can discuss patient scenarios with their potential employer, regardless of the practice model, to be sure they understand what is expected of them and how patient care will be managed within that practice, how aggressive billers might become, and what tasks are delegated to staff.
So you mentioned AMIS. What guidance does AMIS offer regarding different practice models?
AMIS offers oral and maxillofacial surgeons guidance through their parameters of care, code of ethics, and their office anesthesia evaluation program as examples. It's important that OMSs are familiar with these documents so they can discuss how the practice incorporates these guidelines into their practice. I won't go into the specifics of each code section, but we should focus on two important sections of the AAOMS Code of Ethics. First is Section C3. Section C3 states that an OMS's independent judgment should not be compromised. And then there's Section C5. C5 strongly discourages itinerant practices. Itinerant OMS practice, as defined by AMOS, is that which is performed in a non-accredited surgical facility other than the facility owned and or leased by the oral and maxillofacial surgery practice employing the oral surgeon. If, for example, the OMS travels from office to office, but those offices are not the same practice or not owned and run by OMSs, this could be considered itinerant oral surgery.
So is this risk exclusive only to itinerant practices then?
No, it's not. And that's a good point, Bill. These risks are possible in any practice model, but less likely in practices owned and run by OMSs. That's why it's important for OMSs to discuss different patient scenarios with potential practices to get a better understanding.
Well, that makes sense. So let's talk a bit about some of these scenarios. You mentioned earlier that allied staff or other providers may assume more responsibilities. In your experience, then, what does that look like in these practice models?
Well, I would recommend that oral surgeons talk through a typical patient encounter, from scheduling to the patient intake process to the procedure, discharge, and eventual post-op follow-up. They may want to ask the following questions. Who is responsible for obtaining and reviewing the health history? Secondly, who's responsible for the pre-surgical consult? Next, who determines the treatment plan and level of sedation? And then who decides if a medical consultation or clearance is necessary? And then who obtains informed consent? This is often a big issue in large practices. Next is how is the patient information documented and stored? And lastly, who determines when a patient is ready for discharge?
So in your experience, how do the responses to these questions differ across practice models?
Well, in residency and in more traditional OMS practices, the oral surgeon is responsible and involved in the entire process. We have, however, seen some modern practice models rely on staff getting consent forms signed, taking histories, and scheduling patients for certain procedures under a certain level of sedation. In some practices, staff decides whether to obtain medical clearance but lack the education or experience necessary to understand the significance of medical comorbidities and medications, ASA status, Mallampati scores, and risks associated with a very young and very old patient.
All right, so let me ask you this. What if the OMS learns that other staff or providers share some of this responsibility? What then?
Well, I would remind oral surgeons that they are responsible for the staff working under their supervision. Dental practice acts or some state licensure guidelines define what allied staff can and cannot do. It's also important for OMSs to remember that they are held to the standards defined by the state Dental Practice Act. Standards can also be influenced by guidelines, for an example. Dental practice acts vary state by state, but many address OMS responsibilities for patient care.
And then what are the risks OMS may face if these responsibilities are delegated to others?
Well, even if the practice or corporation determines that certain risks are the responsibility of staff or non-OMS providers, the oral surgeon may still be held responsible for any adverse event associated with this delegation of duties. Their license can be jeopardized, as well as their reputation and possibly their livelihood. In short, the OMS will be responsible if something goes wrong with care relating to decisions made or influenced by others. So to protect themselves, I would suggest that oral surgeons make sure they have an opportunity to participate fully in the patient's care and treatment decisions. When you delegate, be sure it's done properly. Take the informed consent process, for example. In most states, the treating oral surgeon has a non-delegable duty to play a substantive role in the informed consent process. This typically includes reviewing the highlights, major benefits and risks of treatment options, and answering questions before the patient consents to a treatment plan. From my perspective, documenting the OMS's role and executing proper OMS procedure-specific consent forms are important parts of the informed consent process. If the practice handles the entire intake and consent process without OMS involvement, oral surgeons may find themselves meeting a patient for the first time in the operatory on the day of surgery. This is not ideal.
So, Richard, wouldn't most surgeons appreciate that? It sounds like that helps them do what they do best, the surgery.
Well, it's true that OMSs are trained surgeons, and it is what they do best, but oral surgeons are also trained to evaluate patients. That's a big part of their practice, ensuring they can perform surgery safely and effectively. Let's continue the scenario we just discussed, with the oral surgeon meeting the patient for the first time on the day of surgery when the patient's in the chair and the oral surgeon walks in. Oral surgeons need to think about what they would do if, after reviewing the patient's medical history and treatment plan, they determine they'd like to consult with a patient's primary care physician about taking the patient off medicine the physician described. Or perhaps the OMS determines that an option exists for only two extractions instead of many, justifying the option of an implant-supported bridge instead of full mouth restorations. If the OMS's independent assessment differs from what was originally planned, will the oral surgeon and patient feel comfortable proceeding with a different treatment or sedation plan? Will the patient be confused or lose confidence in the office? How will the patient, or referring dentist, react if the OMS decides to delay surgery until this is all sorted out? One rule I suggest considering is, when in doubt, err on the side of serving the patient's best interests. Another rule to consider involves the referring or restorative dentist. If the OMS changes the plan, be sure the other treating dentists are informed and agree. Communication is important.
Wow, well, those sound like important scenarios to consider. Are there others that OMS should think about?
I also counsel OMSs entering practice or changing practice models to discuss responsibilities relating to post-op patient care scenarios. When a patient alleges a complication or feels abandoned following a procedure, those allegations will be made against the oral surgeon who performed the procedure, not just the individuals who saw the patient post-op. Risks or confusion can arise when an OMS delegates care to a provider not similarly qualified to recognize, treat, and manage complications. In large group, corporate, or mixed practices, OMSs may not be working full-time or may not be present when their patient returns with a complication. The oral surgeon will want to consider who will see their patient. Other providers may not recognize the need for care, medication, or follow-up that an OMS would consider. Questions the OMS may want to ask the practice in these scenarios might include things like the following. Who will see patients who present with postoperative pain or possible infection, and what is their training? Secondly, will the office contact the OMS if their patient calls or returns with a complication postoperatively? And lastly, what if the patient is admitted to the hospital? Will the treating OMS be informed? In any practice situation, the oral surgeon should know how these decisions are handled and determine if that is the right fit for them.
Okay, so what if the OMS finds out that practices implement some or all of these potentially risky protocols? Does an OMS have any say in adjusting that?
They can, but it often depends on the practice model and the people involved. Oral surgeons are more successful in modifying protocols if they request it before signing the employment agreement. It's easier to negotiate these changes or at least be prepared for working within practice protocols if the OMS knows ahead of time. In my opinion, modern, large, or corporate practices can be run both efficiently and safely if the OMS is sufficiently involved in decision-making, care, treatment, and follow-up. I've talked with other doctors, and I know OMSNIC has as well, who are already employed and later discover that they're not comfortable working within the practice parameters. Practice parameters are usually not stated in the employment agreement. They're discovered later. OMSs may have raised concerns with the practice, but requested changes were not made. I feel for these doctors. If the OMS is not comfortable with the division of tasks, these issues should be considered before they accept a job when possible, but it's not always possible. So I strongly recommend retaining an attorney licensed in your state to help you understand contractual duties and negotiate changes if necessary. Sometimes this has to be done after the oral surgeon has been at a practice for a while.
So Richard, should OMSs build these protocols into their employment agreements?
Protocols for delegating or dividing tasks are typically not all built into employment agreements, but some practice protocols can put oral surgeons at risk. Employment agreement terms and practice protocols should not interfere with an OMS's autonomy to exercise professional judgment. Some of the things OMSs can include and negotiate in their agreements are details relating to quotas, bonuses, and incentives. Quotas and bonuses are typically tied to the quantity of certain procedures performed and revenues collected. We've seen scenarios where OMSs are pressured to upcode or recommend unnecessary procedures. OMSs can be audited by third-party payers when offices aggressively code and bill all extractions as surgicals, find cysts associated with most extracted teeth, bill for alveoloplasties in almost every extraction case, and so on. This can prompt an audit, followed by a refund demand. Oral surgeons should understand how their treatment will be coded and billed, because even if their employer refunds fees under audit, the oral surgeon's reputation can be harmed. If there are certain quotas in the agreement, the OMS will want to be sure they are reasonable.
Richard, we've talked a lot about the pros and cons of practice models and what questions OMS can ask potential employers to better understand the practice model and expectations. Is there anything else that we haven't covered yet that you'd like our listeners to know?
I would be remiss if I didn't mention malpractice insurance in this podcast. Employment agreements may require OMSs to purchase malpractice insurance from certain companies with a certain policy format. I know some of your podcasts will dive into the details of coverage for OMSs, but for now, it's important that oral surgeons know they might be able to negotiate who their carrier is and their policy limits and who pays the premium and whether a tail policy is required upon leaving a practice. I strongly recommend consulting with a local insurance agent familiar with medical professional liability insurance for OMSs to make sure they have appropriate coverage and an aggressive defense available to them, regardless of the practice model in which they practice. An agent will also help the OMS understand the differences between malpractice policies. For example, the OMSNIC policy includes a strong specialized claims defense for OMSs as well as stock ownership. In my experience, OMSs see a significant return on their initial stock investment at retirement. This has been a pleasant surprise to many.
Well, that is great information, and thank you so much for sharing that with us and sharing your insight in this episode. Richard, remember, this is part two of a two-part episode. The transition to practice can be both an exciting and stressful time, and this information will no doubt assist OMS as they evaluate employment and career opportunities. I understand you've also authored a transition to practice guide that summarizes this information, and it's available at omsnick.com. Is that right, Richard?
Yes, it is, and it's a great resource for residents. So thanks, Bill, for having me, and all the best to the OMSs listening.
And once again, that's Richard Small. And for more information, you can always go to omsnick.com. And if you found this podcast helpful, please share it on your social channels and check out the full podcast library for topics of interest to you. This is On Air with OMSNIC. Thanks for listening.
Not familiar with OMSNIC yet? OMSNIC offers unmatched protection and defense exclusively for OMS. Visit our website, omsnick.com, to learn more. Policyholders have access to exclusive complimentary risk management resources such as informed consent forms, videos, and on-demand CE courses.